Welcome to the Other F Word Podcast with Morgan,
Sarah,
and Melissa,
where we talk about that dreaded word, failure. Join us as we explore the messy, tragic, funny, and inspiring stories that make us human. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Other F Word Podcast. We are very excited to have Jace Downey on. She is a recovery empowerment specialist, and we're going to be talking about addiction. Sex addiction and other type of addictions that people deal with. So we're very excited to get on here and talk to you, Jay. So thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm psyched and nervous. I am equally excited and nervous.
Well, don't be nervous. If we fail, we can do a whole episode on our failure in this episode if you want. See, there's we got it covered each way. But I mean, I think one of the things I'm excited about is something I believe is that we all cope with things. We're all coping in things in different ways, you know, some healthy or some not very healthy, you know, but I think addiction's such a big topic. And, you know, so specifically sex addiction, I think is an interesting topic because people don't hear about it as much as alcohol and other types of addiction. So, I mean, I would love to just kind of hear your story and then we'll dive in deeper into the topic. So if you can kind of tell us a little bit of your journey, we would love it.
Yeah, you know, there's self-esteem issues, right? There's low self-esteem, there's low self-worth, and then about 1,000 levels down from that, there is self-loathing. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was a deep and persistent hatred of myself, everything about myself. I couldn't even look in the mirror at who I was for years, so many more years than I actually recognized at the time. I had been using sexual behavior to feel numb, to feel that I was in a position of power, to feel validated, to feel valuable, just all of these things that I perceived I was getting from this sexual behavior. And what I had been using up until that point to self-medicate these behaviors, it stopped working. It wasn't enough. I was still in pain. It wasn't numbing out anymore. And so it was just like, well, if that's not going to work and I am going to have to live with this deep pain, shame, self-hatred, and on top of that, I can't connect with other people because, again, you know, I was lying to every single person I knew. And I thought if anyone really knew who I was, they would be disgusted by me. They would hate me.
So no one knew. And so, no one knew at that
point.
There
was a couple people who were close to me who were around long enough that they had witnessed so much of my destructive behavior that they actually left my life and insisted that I not be in theirs, which was a good call. That was a responsible call on their part. But we didn't know it was sex addiction. Mm-hmm. That wasn't really a thing. There was no information really out there in the public about it, except, you know, like Tiger Woods had gone to recovery and, you know, nobody believed that or whatever it was. So basically, I just thought I was a terrible person. Mm. And because it had been part of my life since I was a small child, I assumed I was born that way and that I was just born broken and I was just born bad. That there's something inherently wrong with me. Right. And so believing all of those things, the next logical step was suicide for me. And so I actively started planning how I was going to go about that in late May of 2014. And in that time, I was recognizing that these coping mechanisms, which I didn't even recognize as coping mechanism, but I realized like I was using sex and sexual behavior. And so I kind of wondered like, okay, if I'm using it like other people use drugs, can it have a similar effect? Like, is that a thing? Can it be destructive and harmful and even addictive like substances? And so I did a quick internet search and the resounding answer was yes, absolutely. And so I started reading and learning about sex addiction. And all of a sudden, it just fell into place. I mean, I'd spent my whole life thinking I was born wrong and that I was unfixable, that no one understood what I was going through, that no one had ever experienced it before. I felt completely alone. And once I realized that was not the case, because here were all these other people and groups and organizations telling my story back to me.
Yeah.
The things I'd never told anyone, these other people understood, and they were experiencing the same pain. And more importantly, they had found a solution. And so I decided, okay, I will go to one meeting. There's a meeting coming up on Thursday night. I will go to that one meeting. And if there's no solution there, I'll kill myself on Friday.
Oh my God.
And so I went to that one meeting. It was at a church, though it was not a church group, but it was at a church. And I was so scared. I honestly thought like I was going to walk into like a dark basement and somehow it would be damp. There'd be like leaks or something. So there's like weird dripping water and it'd be a bunch of like greasy, creepy dudes in trench coats. And that would be terrifying, which I've been in recovery for many years now. And I've never seen anyone wearing a trench coat, just for anyone who's interested. Not a lot of trench coats in the sex addiction community, as it turns out. And so, yeah, I walked in and I was terrified because I thought I walked into the wrong room because it looked like a meeting of the church council. Mm. And it just looked like everyday people, all different ages, all different demographics. They looked like kind, respectable people. And I was like, oh my God, what do I do? What do I tell them? I'm clearly in the wrong room. And then they basically were like, nah, you're in the right room. Like, you look terrified. Come on in. You're where you're supposed to be. And so I did. I sat in that meeting and I heard my story. These people understood the pain that I had been in my entire life. I did not spend 1 minute outside of pain since I was a small child. I do not remember a life without severe pain and terror and isolation.
Was there certain things that caused you to be in pain, or did you?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay.
Totally. I wouldn't discover this fully until 2016, though I had suspicions, but I was sexually abused starting at the age of 5 by my father.
Oh,
and that went on for years. And no one knew. I never told anybody. I never made any indication that anything was wrong. Now that we look back as a family and we've learned about sex abuse in my family now, we can see that there were signs. But we didn't know there were signs, and my mom didn't know there were signs because she didn't know what to look for. And no parent and no family thinks that someone they know could sexually abuse
right.
a child or someone they love. We have this idea that there are people and there are monsters, and that monsters do horrible acts like that. But in truth, statistically, it's something like over 80% of people who do sexual abuse or any kind of sexual violence are people that we know and that we're close to.
Right.
They're not tricky people in vans that take you off the street. They're not, you know, creepy people lurking in playgrounds. It's usually a family member or a friend of the family or a neighbor. It's not a stranger most of the time. And so because we have this idea of like, oh, only monsters do that, we'll be able to recognize a monster when we see one. Well, no, you can't, because they're not monsters. They're people. And everyone loved my dad.
Yeah.
You know, he was like Norm from Cheers. When he walked into a room, people would be like, Joe, and they'd be excited to see him. He was smart. He was charismatic. You know, he also was an addict, and, you know, that is super common. Addiction is a genetic brain disease. So it's really common to have multiple addicts in one family. But, I got the message very young that my worth came from what someone could take from me physically and sexually.
Right, right. And were so left alone with that as a child.
Completely alone. Completely alone. And most people who experience sexual abuse feel that it is their fault. And it took me extensive therapy in adulthood to accept the fact that as a 5-year-old child, it absolutely was not my fault that that happened to me.
God, no.
Since I thought it was my fault, I felt like I couldn't tell anyone because I was the guilty party in it.
Of course, that confusion and fear. And so at five and as you got older, what were the signs you were showing looking back?
Extreme anger. I had a temper like you would not believe. That's very common of sexual abuse survivors. I also was weirdly particular about my physical body. And so there was a long-standing joke in my family about socks. Mm-hmm. I could not handle socks that were too tight or too loose, or if I could feel the seam on my toes, I would throw hysterical fits if I did not have the right socks. And now we know that people who go through sexual abuse are very particular and they want to feel like they have control over their body.
Right.
And so they're very particular about that because I wanted to feel like I was allowed to control something happening to my physical body.
Right.
I had the same thing with getting wet. If I got wet, I one time kicked through my mom's windshield because some liquid spilled on my lap in the car as a kid because it made me feel like I was not in control of my body.
Right. Right.
And I freaked out.
Wow. That's, and again, I want people who are listening, who have kids, maybe who are sensitive and have sensory issues that are similar, right? The socks don't fit, the seams on the socks are uncomfortable or water is uncomfortable, that doesn't mean that your child is being sexually abused. I just want people to hear that because it's also a sensory integration or just a sensitivity for some kids. But I think hearing your story, it makes also so much sense that your body was being violated. And so anything you could control or anything that felt out of control sent you over the edge. A whole different,
definitely.
That's a whole different kind of part of this picture.
Right. And that was one area that we're able to look back now and say, oh, because, you know, it was thought that I was just like a high maintenance kid or I was a spirited child,
right.
That I had like too much anger. I had anger issues. No kid should be that angry. There's no reason for a small child to be as angry as I was. I also was terrified at night to go by windows, to go into any kind of unknown space, like even my room in the dark. And some, you know, many kids are afraid of the dark.
Yeah,
but I would be paralyzed in fear. And my mom just kept being like, but what are you afraid of? And I couldn't answer her.
Do you think in hindsight, was there anything she could have said or done to help you to open up to what was really going on?
Man, my mom is like a textbook good parent. I'm very fortunate in that one of my parents was phenomenal. And then the other one was not at all. But my parents were divorced since I was 6 months old. So this wasn't happening in the house.
Right.
Around, like it was just me. So she had no reason to suspect it or anything like that. And she was very loving. She still is. My mom's like my favorite human in all of time. She's like this really phenomenal person. And so she was very loving, very engaged with us when we were kiddos, very affectionate. I never wondered if my mom was able to love me or that I was in a safe place. The only thing that I can say now that I've looked back on this a lot and we've started a big family dialogue around it, my mom was a single mom and she was raising three kids by herself in the 80s and 90s while also working full time and doing her best to, you know, try to climb the corporate ladder to make better money and have a better situation for us and all of those things. And so she had to be super strong and resilient in order to do that. And she did a great job. I mean, she made us dinner every night, helped us with our homework, took us to the park. And like, I mean, she was very engaged as a parent. She's super cool.
That's incredible.
And so in order to do a lot of that to do it well, she had to push a lot of her stuff aside. She was not able to deal with, you know, her emotional stuff or her life stuff because she was trying to raise three kids and raise us well, and to bring in sufficient income and all of those things. And also, I think she had this idea that she needed to be this like pillar of strength. And so because we didn't commonly see my mom go through stuff, and we didn't have a situation where we talked about these things, because that's not how either of my parents were brought up at all. You don't share your tough stuff or your vulnerabilities in quite right. the same way.
We talk about that so much on this podcast, is how important it is for parents to to be vulnerable when they make a mistake, like sit down, that's so reparative to your kids and so important to show your own failures and your own vulnerability. You know, and I thought it was really interesting what you said about your dad, you know, just how it's not the monster. And I think, you know, secrets, just people have secrets. And I think even this podcast, obviously we're not trying to solve, you know, abuse, but I think what one of the things we're trying to do is just talk about things that people, make it okay to talk about things you're scared of, you know, because a lot of it is those secrets and those hidden things that just, and it becomes a darker hole that people don't visit. And to make those things more speakable and saying, I'm really struggling with this, then there's some healing there, you know? So I think it's beautiful the way you said that.
Absolutely.
It also normalizes, you know, all the things that you were feeling, like if you had seen it in your mother. And I mean, there are very real reasons why she wasn't able to do that. And it's understandable. I mean, the burden that she must have been carrying. And yet, for you, it was unfortunate because it didn't normalize anything that you were feeling. And there was, I guess, no space for you to express it.
And honestly, now that I'm an adult and I look back and I know my mom, both as a parent and as a woman now, it would have been 1,000% fine for me to come to her and tell her that or anything. But I didn't know that as a child.
Right.
I also thought that what was going on was my fault and that I was bad and that I was unlovable as a result of it. Mm. And so it's not just that I didn't want to get dad in trouble. Right. I didn't want my mom to stop loving me. Right. And I thought if she knew what I had done, she wouldn't love me anymore.
Oh God, you are articulating something that so many kids struggle with, even if it's not as severe as sexual abuse by a family member, but that feeling of being a failure or being broken and the worry that you're going to burden your parents with your overwhelm or chase them away because you're bad. I mean, I think you are articulating something that people feel all the time. And again, you being able to just say that, I think, is so healing for other people. Because I imagine, as you just said, when you did come to your mom, that she would have been okay. She would have been able to handle it, right? She would have been able to help. And yet there's this message that it's too much or that you're too broken. It's such a tragedy, but it makes so much sense. You're just a kid.
Like it'd be a disappointment. Yeah. I really felt like it would be a disappointment to my mom, I would be a disappointment to my mom done these horrible things.
How did she react when you finally told her? Was she devastated?
Well, I'll tell you this is my mom. Like, you want the short version of my mom, here's my mom, right? So in 2015, in October, I had decided before this that I couldn't live in hiding around my recovery either.
Right.
And Oasis was still in 2014. And so once I went into recovery, I started my second double life. Because just as much as it's not okay to be in active sex addiction, it's also not okay to be in recovery from sex addiction in our society. So I was lying all over again. I was lying about the places I was going. I was lying about the people I was spending time with. I was lying about what I was doing. I was lying all the time again. And I realized, like, okay, I'm not going to really get well if I'm lying all the time. And also, I hated lying to my mom. I hate it. Like, that breaks my heart. And so I decided when I go home next, I'm going to tell mom. And so it was in October. And she and I had talked all night, which is totally our jam. That's what we do. And so I realized, like, okay, I have to tell her now. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning. But, you know, I sat her down. I said, Mom, before we go to sleep, there's something I want to tell you, which is not what a parent wants to hear ever. You never want your child to sit you down and be like, Mom, we need to talk. And so we sat down and she looked terrified. And I said, Mom, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you the general information. I'm not going to tell you any details. However, I will answer any questions you have, and I'll answer them honestly. But this is important to me that you become aware of this. And she said, okay. And so I said, Mom, for the last few months, I have been in recovery for sex addiction. And I explained to her how I got into recovery, about being suicidal and about the double life and hating myself, all of these things, you know, in a broad sense, I explained that to her. And she's crying at this point. And she takes me by the hand with tears in her eyes. And she says, honey, I am so sorry you felt like you had to go through this alone. Aww. She wasn't mad. She wasn't grossed out. She wasn't disappointed. I didn't lose an ounce of her respect. It just broke her heart that I was suffering by myself and that I almost killed myself because of the pain I was in. And I had not shared that with anyone. And I didn't give her a chance to help me. That made her so sad. And she told me, there is nothing you could ever say to me or ever do that would make me stop loving you.
Oh, it's so beautiful. And I just think it's the most amazing thing in life to me, that I think sometimes we all feel that way. We always feel like this person won't love me if I tell them that. But when you're actually vulnerable and honest with people, you become more lovable to them. And, you know, they really see the real you, you know? And it's just this thing that's so hard for us to do.
And you want to hear a joke about it all?
What's that?
The big joke that surrounds that in life is, as I have been a public speaker about being a sex addict, as well as someone who went through sexual abuse, and someone who has a myriad of mental illnesses, every time I share with someone my experience and my broken parts, they tell me something about themselves.
Yeah, it gives them permission to... 99%
of the time.
Yeah.
Yes, we are so hungry to connect. And I think we're so tired of keeping up the act of everything's okay. And like this idea on like social media where it's like, oh, I have to look like my life's perfect and everything's great. And when someone asks like, how are you doing? I have to say like, oh, I'm fine. Or everything's going really well. I'm successful. Look at how many things I have in order. It's just like, we're tired of it.
Oh, we're all broken and just full of shit, you know?
Yeah, it's not natural. We're not designed as human beings to be in isolation or to go through things alone. We are designed to be in community and to work in community and to deal with stuff and to heal in community.
Yeah.
And so when I tell people like, here's my dark secret, they're almost like, oh, thank God. Mm-hmm. Can I tell you mine? And even at like, I was at a job interview a while back and the person said, you know, hey, I've seen you online. I Googled you. And I'm like, oh, okay. I don't know how this conversation's going to go. And we spent the next hour with him telling me about things that happened to him during childhood and like trauma and addiction in his family and all this stuff. And like, that was half of the interview, was us talking about the suffering he'd been in. And that's not uncommon. And so the big joke is, you know, we think we have to hide all of this and that we have to put our best foot forward in order to be loved. But everyone is dying to just be who they are, to be their beautiful, broken self and be loved and accepted for it.
Amen.
And the more we do more we are going to be loved and accepted.
Absolutely. Because I always, you know, I do a good bit of, I'm a writer, so I've been writing about this topic a lot lately. And I was, you know, if you're putting on that kind of fake version of you where you're perfect, the person they're even loving, you know, is not really you. You know what I'm saying? So it never feeds you. Like, you keep putting. And one other thing I want to say real quick is, you know, like, armor can be a good thing. You know, like in battle, you need armor. The problem, it's coping. The problem is when you wear that armor around to eat and sleep and do all these things, it just weighs you down so much. So I love, like, I think when you get in recovery and they can just like, you can, or just that honesty of being yourself just lets you lay that armor down, because it's protective in ways, but it's also burdensome if you're wearing it all the way. But I want to say too, just as a man, I think too, I love your strength as like a woman, because I got to imagine it's harder for women to talk about this. I think it's probably easier for a man to go to their parent and be like, hey, I have sex addiction. You know, there's a shame. a burden that you shouldn't have to bear more than a man does in that thing, you know?
So the thing about sex addiction and stigma and shame, I hear that a lot where people say, you know, it's easier or it's harder for you as a woman to admit to these things and to talk publicly about them. And truthfully, it's not easier or harder for either gender. They both have their own difficulties. Mm-hmm. So for a woman, you know, we have a lot of stigma around sex in general. And there's that dichotomy of we're told and shown, especially in the media, that our power comes from our sexuality, how good looking we are, how appealing we are, how sexually enticing we are. That's where our power comes from. So it tells us be sexy, but don't have sex. You know, it's like this other, then there's the flip side of that where we're supposed to be the pillars of morality in society. And you can't be both unless you're living a double life, which, you know, I was. Mm-hmm. And so in one sense, mm-hmm. yes, there's definitely stigma around yes. sex and sex addiction for women. However, because it's this, you know, quote unquote, new thing, which it's not, but we're hearing about it for the first time and women are coming out and saying like, hey, I connect with that as well. There aren't these negative connotations that already go with it. And so when I say I'm a sex addict, people go, wait, what? That's a real thing and it can affect women? When a man says they're a sex addict, some of the first reactions around that are fear. Because people hear sex addict and they hear sexual predator, mm-hmm. they hear pervert and they hear pedophile. And because women just have, I guess, a softness about them, they think we can't do any harm.
Right.
And so when men say that they are struggling with sex addiction, there's fear that can result in that. And then additionally, when women say, I was sexually abused, there's empathy and support. When men say, I was sexually abused as a child, people say, all right, you know, you can't be sexually abused because men always want sex. And like, oh, an older woman, you know, touched your genitals or made you have intercourse with her. Like, ooh, what a stud. Like, you think that's bad? Something's wrong with you because you think that that's a bad thing. And it's like, no, anytime someone does not want sexual behavior happening to them and it's happening to them, it causes such a unique and severe wound.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't care what age someone is at, but kids do not want sexual things happening to them at all, ever.
And add to the complication of a boy being sexually abused by a man, even more,
right,
a straight boy or not, the confusing feelings that come up and like a double layer of shame.
Absolutely. So it's hard for everyone, male or female, the addiction part of it, and then also the abuse part of it as well. And honestly, sexual abuse is very common. Any abuse, physical, emotional, or sexual abuse is extremely common with sex addicts, but with any addict as well. There's a direct link between, yes, of course, the genetics of the brain disease of addiction, but also trauma happening in early life.
Yeah. And were you ever able to confront your father?
I was not. So my dad died when I was 13. And at this point, the abuse had stopped by then.
Thankfully.
And I had a lot of love for my dad. I was, you know, like the closest one to my dad.
Oh, boy.
And so when he died, that was really hard for me. That was really hard on me when he passed. And I didn't really recognize or acknowledge the sexual abuse until 2016.
Was it buried sort of in your psyche?
And he was long past. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, physically, I had feelings of something having happened. But one, nobody wants to believe that that happened to them. And if you can hide from it, why wouldn't I want to do that? And then I didn't want to believe that it had been my dad.
Right.
So there was a lot pushing that away. And then, of course, we know with trauma, the brain, it changes how the brain develops.
Right.
And in order to survive, like the brain is this amazing modality for survival, not for health, not for our overall holistic health, but for survival. And so it does what it needs to keep us moving, to keep us alive. Totally. And so we see a lot of changes in the brain with trauma, and then of course with addiction as well, operating more out of that limbic system. And so, no, I didn't confront my dad. I have done work, of course, in therapy around my abuse. I did EMDR therapy, which is very effective with trauma. And I've had both written and out loud conversations with my father as well. And if you think that sounds crazy, get to know me. That's the least of the crazy things I do.
But I think, you know, what in your description of your relationship with your dad, I think what you're showing is how complicated, confusing, and layered these relationships are. And you bring a sense of empathy to the whole situation, because it's so easy to get angry and judge and think of your dad as a monster. And yet, you know, if he were alive, we could probably figure out that he probably had some trauma going on that was unresolved and that he was really suffering. And so I think if anything, if we can kind of slow down, as we always talk about, and try to understand, it doesn't take him off the hook and it doesn't make it okay, but to just try to have some compassion for the deep, deep level of suffering that so many people go through. And we talk about this multi-generational transmission of trauma, that if it's unresolved, it keeps repeating itself and getting acted out in each generation, and that you've had the courage to stop it, and that's incredible, because it can just keep going.
Thank you.
And you know, to have that kind of strength and clarity and insight, and then the ability to share it, because it's so compelling and it's so powerful, and so many people are suffering quietly and in shame, you know. And I wonder if you can just say a little bit more about what does sex addiction look like? And I know it's different for everyone,
sure.
But I think there's kind of a misunderstanding about what does that really look like, or what did it look like for you?
Absolutely. And first, thank you for your support around the empathy that I do have for my dad and others who go on to be abusers, because you're absolutely right. Those who go on to hurt others are also hurt themselves. And of course, there's a lot that backs that up. And I do know that my dad has gone through trauma, and I see two people suffering in that situation, not just one evil person acting towards another. You know, there were two victims there, and empathy does not equal excusing his behavior.
Right.
But as long as we want to keep pretending that those people are bad and that they just were evil, we're not going to solve the actual problem. And I think what everyone wants is for no children to ever be abused ever again. And in order to do that, we are going to have to empathize with the abuser.
Yeah. And that's such an important distinction on what you said. I think that's so, so great that you can forgive and be empathetic, but not necessarily, you know, you're not sanctioning it. But let me just ask you, before you do get into the description of what sex addiction can look like, how did you come to these, how did you resolve these issues, or how were you able to kind of come around on some of these things and heal, aside from the
That's a really great question.
From the group therapy the addiction groups that you were part of.
Sure. So education is one of my number one tools in my tool belt, because I learned about abuse, I learned about trauma, and of course I learned about addiction. And that, you know, learning that those who abuse were also abused in most cases. I learned from my own experience, once I started coming into reality about my addictive behavior and what I was actually doing in my life, I was able to have a lot of empathy for others and how they were showing up, especially others who suffer with addiction, because I totally get it. I get it. But really understanding what is going on the side of the abuser made that a lot easier for me, because I was able to just go, okay, it's not an evil person. what's next? Like,
right.
I really want to solve this.
Can I just interrupt you though and ask, when you say education, do you mean by reading books? Do you mean going on the internet? Where did you get your information?
So reading books, yes. Internet searching, of course, there's tons of blogs and information out here. And while I was working on my Suddenly Celibate project, I also had the phenomenal opportunity to talk to some really amazing experts around the country with regard to addiction and sex addiction specifically, and then trauma and abuse and sexual violence and all sorts of things. And so I got to talk to some people who specialize in these areas directly and ask like my own personal questions, which is like a really great thing to get to do.
Yeah.
But there are tons of resources out there, of course, to learn about this. These are not secret things. Yes, we're not talking about them much in society yet, but we're going to have to.
Absolutely.
We just can't keep putting people in that, and we can't keep being silent because it's uncomfortable. Nobody wants to talk about children being abused in any way because it's so big and it's like so scary. And it's like, well, what do we do? But we have to talk about it. We have to talk about that. We've got to talk about addiction. We've got to talk about mental illness. And we have got to start talking about how sexuality is tied to humanity. We're at a point in history and in life where being silent around these things because they're uncomfortable is no longer acceptable. There are too many people suffering to excuse that any longer. And we have the means and we have the resources and we have people like you guys who are blowing it up.
Blowing it
up. Let's talk about it. Let's just talk about it. Do anything. Let's just talk about it.
You've come to the right place.
And that's really what's going to be the big difference. Yeah. It's just starting conversations, open conversations.
Well, and again, so I keep using the word brave because these conversations are brave. They're hard to do and people avoid having hard conversations. And yet it is so necessary. And as Morgan said, it's so connecting. And you're right. When anything that involves sexuality can feel so private or so shameful or so personal that, and again, you know, it could feel so taboo, but you add sex and then addiction and it's kind of explosive on so many levels. So I think it's even more important to get the word out about what does that look like?
Definitely. So sex addiction is estimated to be the number one addiction, at least in America and possibly all over the world. It's the least talked about, but it is something that affects the largest amount of people. Now that will take years before we actually have statistics around it because of the stigma. But I'll explain a little bit and then we'll talk about why it's so prevalent. So sex addiction can show up everywhere from fantasy and not ever touching another human being. It can show up as, for me, a big part of mine because it started when I was so young was compulsive masturbation. Mm-hmm. And that means masturbating to the point of hurting myself, actually hurting my genitals, but then continuing anyway, masturbating in inappropriate places because there seemed to be no wall, no filter that said, and stop.
Right.
Like, this is not appropriate.
Right.
And so pornography is a big part of that. And we're seeing more and more of that with internet pornography being so accessible and being accessed as children, kids. The average age of pornography viewing now is 11.
Yes, we just did a whole episode on that. Yep. Terrifying.
Yeah, it's scary. And so pornography can show up. Voyeurism, so watching other people, even not watching sexual things, but just watching other people while they don't know they're being watched is voyeurism. Exhibitionism is showing yourself. Exhibitionism, and that can also show up as sex addiction. Frauderism is when someone pushes their genitals or their body against someone else without permission. That can show up in sex addiction.
Any
of course,
boundary violation, which makes sense.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, actual intercourse, of course, is part of that as well. And that can be in a lot of different respects. So like there's this idea, and I get this question a lot through my YouTube channel, how many partners do I have to have sex with, or how often do I have to have sex before I'm considered a sex addict?
Yeah.
That's not how that works. So we have this old school mentality in addiction that has thus been proved not accurate, but it got the headlines for so long that it's still some misinformation out there. But there's this idea that if, say, like a totally healthy person just does something enough, they'll become addicted to it. That's not really proving true. And that certainly isn't the case with sex addiction. And so it's not even necessarily the number of partners that one has or how the frequency of sex. And we do hear those because they're a little more sensational, like, oh my gosh, woman has slept with, you know, or man has slept with X number of people. Or there was one on the BBC that was like 5 times a day was not enough for this woman. That, yes, is one area, but really with sex addiction, it's any sexual behavior or fantasy. So we can, it can include thoughts as well. So even inactive behavior in the brain that is going on compulsively for the World Health Organization says at least 6 months, that there are adverse effects, that there are consequences that don't, which does not stop the behavior, that there are repeated attempts to stop with no success. Mm-hmm. And that we see a lot, you know, someone mentioned boundaries, that your own boundaries are being crossed, that you're setting up rules and restrictions for yourself and you're unable to maintain those and stick to those. And really what it comes down to in the simplest form, mm-hmm, is anything on the sexual spectrum, fantasy or action, that is causing adverse effects in one's life with the inability to stop them. And most of the time, especially as the disease progresses, these are activities that are not bringing any form of pleasure. Mm. And that's another area of confusion as well, where it's like, so you like to have sex a lot, who cares? No, 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 no. I was having sex or engaging in sexual activities that were bringing no joy to me, no pleasure to me. Sometimes they were very painful. Sometimes they were very painful. They were degrading. They were completely outside of my boundaries and morals. They were unenjoyable. And I still felt compelled to continue them. It is not a fun thing. It's not an exciting thing. It's not a glamorous thing. It is painful and it's scary
and dangerous, it's hard. And right?
This is something that destroys lives. Right. Yes, dangerous. It's deadly.
Right.
This is not a funny thing or like a people like, oh, sex addiction. No, this is a serious illness that affects millions of people. And people are, you know, there's suicide is a super common thing around sex addiction for the obvious reasons, stigma, isolation, lack of education, all of that. And so it shows up just like any other addiction would, mm-hmm, just like drinking would, only it's around sexual behaviors.
Which I think makes it a little bit more confusing for people. And so I'm so glad that you are sharing your own experience, because to hear that it wasn't pleasurable, it wasn't enjoyable, you were putting yourself at risk, it was even painful and scary, that's a really important distinction, because I think there's a lot of confusion around that. Oh, sex is pleasurable. What's so bad about a lot of it? But the addiction piece, mm-hmm, takes it to a different level, you know, much like drugs or alcohol or any substances, that it's then impacting your life in such a profound way.
And it goes far beyond a want to a perceived need. And not a need, it is a perceived need for survival, mm-hmm, because in addiction, it's operating in the limbic part of the brain, which is our old school part of the brain that says, you know, life or death, fight or flight, you're about to die unless you do this thing. And even though there's no rational sense, of course, I'm not going to die if I don't act out sexually or if I don't watch pornography or masturbate or search the online sites or whatever. No, I'm not going to die. But because addiction is a brain disease and there's actually a disconnect, right, happening in the brain and there's, right, less gray matter, those consequences don't get in because that connection between the limbic system, mm, and the prefrontal cortex are not happening. Wow. Not because that person doesn't have willpower, they're not strong enough, or they're immoral. Their brain does not operate the same way that a healthy brain operates.
So then how how, I mean, you started talking about, you know, you were you educated yourself and you were part of a recovery group, but how can people make those connections again and find ways out of what can be such a bleak situation?
Oh my gosh. The brain is amazing. It's so malleable. It continues to grow and change for our whole lives. So though these things are happening in the brain is healable and it can change and we can change our neural pathways and we can actually alter our brain. So that's really cool. So it is not a bleak situation. There's tons of hope around it. And of course, addiction's been around forever. You know, it's been something that's been focused on in a recovery sense for almost 100 years now. There's, you know, science and continuing science on it and growing science. So it's definitely not new. Sex addiction is new in the media, but recovery for sex addiction has been around since the 80s. And it's a growing field as well. And so the top three things, I actually just did a video about this week. The top three things that I suggest for someone who believes that they are suffering with a sex addiction is find a community. You have got to have people that you feel you can trust, that you can be completely honest with, who are going to support you in your recovery process.
Right.
There are lots of different types of communities. I am involved in a 12-step community around sex addiction and have a deep love for my family, my 12-step family. But there's non-12-step programs. There are church programs. There are science programs. There are Buddhist programs. There are so many different groups that can be joined. And these are growing. So they're in-person groups. There's also online groups and there's telephone groups as well. There are forums you can join. But you got to find a community because we cannot deal with this alone. Every addict I've ever met thought at first that they could deal with it alone. You can't, I can't, we can't. We're not designed that way as people. We need to get in with other people who are just as messed up as we are. It's very important.
Well, which is everyone,
so
by the way.
That's number one. Number two, getting educated.
Right.
Having an education around what sex addiction is and what it is not, and then what options there are, is super important. Of course, there's tons of misinformation around sex addiction. And so getting actual clarity around it as a real thing is very important. And knowing that there are physical components like in the brain that are going to be need to be dealt with. And then there are mental and emotional ones as well, as we go back and deal with the trauma or abuse or adverse childhood experiences that are going to have to be dealt with. And so getting education around like what we each need specifically, because it is catered to everyone individually. And then the other is to get in some kind of counseling. And there are so many options nowadays to fit every flavor that you could think of for therapy or counseling. And also a wide spectrum for cost as well. I know a lot of people say that they can't afford therapy or counseling. No way. I've been in therapy when I've been dead broke, when I've had no income. There are organizations that do help people get into counseling. But because this is not just a matter of like having too much sex, and there's so much that has gone into it, and it has been going on for most of us since childhood, having a great counselor, ideally one that understands and deals with sex addiction specifically, would be great. But at the very least, someone who has a background in addiction and trauma.
And maybe you can just say a little bit before we wrap up about how you are today. How are you doing today? Because you've shared so much about your past and so much about, you know, 4 years ago. But how are you doing today? Clearly, you're helping others and inspiring others and educating others. And yet it's definitely an ongoing process. Maybe you can just share a little bit before we wrap up.
You bet. Oh my gosh, that's my favorite area. Right? Yes, like, of course, addiction and trauma and these things are dark and they're hard. Like, the work is hard. I'm not going to lie to you. That recovery work is hard. However, it is one of the only areas in life that is guaranteed to give you out what you put in. Mm-hmm. And working to deal with this stuff, working hard, translates to an extraordinary life. It is so amazing the things that recovering addicts are capable of. I think, no offense to present company included, I think that recovering addicts are the most powerful beings in all of living existence.
Agreed.
So is my life perfect? No. It sure isn't. Do I still mess up regularly? Yes. Like, one of my great successes right now is that for the last like 11 days consistently, I've taken my vitamins, and that's a big success.
Right.
So it's like, have I nailed it? No, you're right. These are things that I'll be dealing with for the rest of my life.
Well, welcome to being
as
human.
As a result of that. Yeah. I'm like so deeply more human than I ever thought I was going to be. Because as a person who is an addict and also has trauma in my background, in order to be alive, I have to focus on these things directly. And because I have the benefit of having to deal with this stuff directly, I get to grow through it. Mm-hmm. And I get to find out who I really am. And it's life or death for most of us in addiction. And so my life depended on me going through and dealing with all of this stuff. And as a result, I am the healthiest I've ever been. I'm in the best romantic relationship I've ever been. Mm-hmm. The people around me love me and support me, and they respect me and they rely on me. They trust me. I've gone from lying to everyone I know and people not wanting me in their life to being a reliable, respected person. And the best part of it all is I thought I was going to go through this process and find out that I was just a shitty person.
Right.
Wrong.
Right.
I am a person that I love so much. And I even like, I'm fun. I have so much fun by myself. Y'all don't even know. Like,
tell. That was going to be my.
And so, you know, it's like, yes, I get to have this life I love, but I get to be someone I love. And I owe that to recovery. I owe that to doing the work to move past active addiction and suffering from trauma.
Oh my God. I mean, thank you. Because just hearing how you felt broken and flawed for so much of your life, and that you can work through it and celebrate yourself. And my next question was, are you having healthy relationships? So you answered that, because I think that's the other piece that people worry about, that they'll forever feel broken in that area of trust and intimacy and love. And for you, I think it's clear that you've been able to.
Absolutely.
Find
and I have to add component of, not only am I a sex addict, but I also am a public sex addict. And so, you know, the man that was going to accept that was going to have to be pretty open-minded. And fun twist in the plot, I met my partner in recovery. He is also a sex addict, and we are going through this together. We offer great support and space to each other in our recovery programs. And so not only did I find someone that was going to love and accept me as I am, he also knows who I was, what I've been through, what I've done. And let's be real, it wasn't just all stuff being done to me. I've done some pretty awful things as well.
Yeah.
And he really knows me and really loves and accepts me.
Yeah.
We get to have like a really respectful relationship, which is also tons of fun. And also, for anyone wondering, and you didn't ask, but I'm going to tell you anyway, sex as a person in recovery is way hotter and more fun and more connected and just a million times better than any of the sex I ever had in active addiction.
Well, that was going to be my next question. So, of course, Jace, thank you for saying that, because I think, again, that is, everybody has their curiosity about it, and yet maybe it's just hard to ask. It feels intrusive, and it's so important, though, to talk about this hard stuff and feel hopeful.
Absolutely. And we've developed this really weird idea that sex and life are separate, that sex is something in the shadows, and that it's a secret and private thing, and that it doesn't affect every other part of our life. But through my new project, Sex Life, I am exploring and investigating how our humanity is tied to our sexuality, and they're completely woven together. And so this idea that, like, oh, we don't talk about certain things and those just stay on the sidelines, they do not. They right. come with us, whether we're talking about them yeah. or not.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. We love the work you're doing. It's amazing. And I so agree. I mean, I just, anytime we've talked to people in recovery, there's just such a, I think like there's just such an open heart, and there's such a, cause you're living your authentically yourself. You're just being your real you, and you're not judgmental of other, you're just the space. So it just attracts people to you. And it's just such a, I think that's what we're all looking for, you know, is just to be ourselves in that space of not being judged, and we can just be, you know, we can be real. So I think that's what you're doing for people through your own example and your work. And it's such a beautiful, beautiful gift to us here on the podcast and everyone out there. So thank you so much.
Thank you guys for giving a space where we can be like, oh, hey, by the way, I'm broken. And you guys celebrate that as part yeah. of being successful. And part of being healthy and happy is also being broken. So yeah. I love what you guys are doing. I really do.
Oh, you're awesome. Thank you so much, Jace.
It's a great service to the world.
Well, gosh, you have shared so much amazing, inspiring, helpful, moving information. Your story is amazing. Thank you so much. And if people want to find you...
Oh, my goodness. My pleasure.
If people want to find you online, where can they, or just in general, where can they find you?
Sure. I can be found through my website, which is just www.jacedowney.com. There are I'm just relaunched, so new resources being added all the time, and also people can book recovery empowerment sessions there with me as well if they'd like. And I am on YouTube as well, putting out weekly videos talking about sex and life and sex addiction and mental illness and everything in between.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Jason. I also want to say I would say email us at info@theotherfwordpodcast. Unfortunately, we have shifted over. So if we haven't gotten your email, we really apologize. We shifted services and some emails got lost, but feel free to continue to email us at info@theotherfwordpodcast. And thanks so much to our producer, Bipasha Sean. We really appreciate it. Thanks so much. See you next time. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Other F Word Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast, and visit us online at theotherfwordpodcast.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And we'd love to hear your stories of struggle with failure. You can contact us at info@theotherfwordpodcast.com. See you next time.